Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Well, first of all, Fielding, my presidency is not over. I've got another 5 years coming up. We're going to get this done. And you know, absolutely we have strong support in the Latino community because they've seen what we've been working on. First of all, strengthening the economy. We just were able to get the payroll tax cut done. That provides 25 million Latinos with an extra $40 in every paycheck and is going to help strengthen the economy. We made sure that unemployment insurance got extended because the Latino community has been so hard hit. 1 million Latinos are going to be benefiting from that. The housing settlement that we just passed, which will help Latino families all across the country who were taken advantage of by subprime lenders to be able to stay in their homes.
I have a fear that Obama will win re-election. And the reason I say that is because the bland played on. And so I ask you, what would you do if Obama wins re-election? What would you do? I mean, I heard things in the past of what people would do if various presidents won on the left or the right. They'd leave the country, they'd do this, they'd do that. How would you change your life if the most, I don't want to say left-wing, because this is not a left-wing government in the sense that we know it. This is the first naked Marxist that we've ever had in the White House. It's the first Marxist presidency on a minor scale at this point, but not so minor when you consider he passed the NDAA, which gives him the right, the sole right, the tyrannical right, the authoritarian right, to arrest an American citizen, even to execute them without trial. I don't think you understand what's happening in front of your eyes, but what will you do if Obama wins re-election? I have a fear he may win re-election, and I'll tell you why. I was reading a blog at Harvard Law blog, and they say that people are afraid of change and will favor an incumbent if one is available. They say Obama ended the Iraq War and he will get credit for it. They say Americans know in their hearts that Obama is not responsible for the stagnant economy. Now, that's all true for the average person. Those who have studied this administration recognize it is the most corrupt in American history. I only have to say the word Solyndra, but that's only the tip of the iceberg. The economy is not growing at all. So what does Mitt Romney offer, assuming he becomes the Republican opposition? Well, he could say that he's a businessman, which is true. But his business record will be analyzed and sifted and sorted. And by the time the deviants on the left get through with him, they will make his business record look anything but what he wants it to be. The fact of the matter is there's a lot of problems in this country that have more to do with the people than it does with the individual leading the country. There happen to be an awful lot of Americans who on average don't really work that hard and haven't achieved very much. In other words, they're lazy and they're losers. The fact of the matter is you can blame the politicians all you want, but if you look around the world, you can see that we are out of control. As they point out in this blog, a country has people who earn a median wage of $16.27 per hour, and they cannot afford to pay $100,000 to $200,000 a year in pensions to policemen and firefighters who retire at 42 or 50 after rigging the system, retiring with medical benefits based upon false illnesses that they claim they got in their last year of service. We know that we can't afford our massive military or unlimited payments to Medicare providers without taxing people at 100% of their income. We know that we cannot afford to pay working-age people to sit home and watch television and collect 99 weeks of unemployment benefits. We know that China is growing 10% per year. Why? Because businesses there have employees who have a better education and a better work ethic than the idiot children who are coming out of our schools. We know that countries like Singapore now enjoy a higher per capita income than the United States does. Why? because they can deliver basic government services at a tiny fraction of the cost as a percentage of GDP because they're not bound by union criminality. We know that our public schools are set up to benefit teachers and administrators rather than students and unions, and therefore the outlook for competitiveness has gotten worse, not better, with the advent of this twisted, topsy-turvy system. And so, therefore, if you look at our politicians, if you look at Romney or you look at Obama or you look at any of the others, what do you think is going to happen? And I raise the question, if Obama wins re-election because of all of what I've just said to you, what will you do? Will you change your life? Will you leave the country? Will you go along as you have gone on? Because as the bland played on, it looks very much to me as though Obama is the real winner. The Republicans are killing each other, as we have said. Listen to clip 20. This is Obama. Our military will be leaner. Listen to this.
So, yes, our military will be leaner, but the world must know the United States is going to maintain our military superiority with armed forces that are agile.
You know what? He can't even say the word. He can't even lie anymore. He'd stumble on the word superiority. You got to understand, this guy hates the U.S. military. He has a vendetta to destroy the military. That's all he wants to do. And with the kind of leadership that we don't have in politics and the lack of leadership we have in the military because they've all been culled out, they've been thrown out of the military if one of them showed any signs of testosterone. They're just like Romney. The entire leadership in the U.S. military may as well be Mitt Romney. I'm telling you, that's what it looks like to me. When have you seen a vociferous guy like a, never mind a Patton, a MacArthur? Nobody. They don't exist. They're all get along, go along kind of corporate guys. They'll do whatever the president says without a word, without a peep out of them. Now, you're saying, well, what would you do about the fact that we're broke and we can't afford the military? Well, that's an intriguing question. Number one, what you got to do is cut back on the medical care for the entire family of every military person. It's medical care, medical care, medical care that is killing this country. There's an entitlement mentality about what you are entitled to from a government or from a union that is out of touch with reality. Nobody has ever been afforded this level of care in the history of the world because nobody can afford this. This entitlement for medical care pharmaceuticals is what's killing not only the country, but killing the military. That's what I believe. And then I want to talk about pensions for a minute because, you know, right now it's very popular to bash public employee pensions, and I'm all for it. But not with regard to cops. I thought about it in great detail. And, you know, you say, well, we can't afford these pensions for cops. I would separate out the police pensions. I would certainly crack down on the corrupt police who spend the last few months of the last year building up their pension with a fake illness. I would crack down on that. I wouldn't cut police pensions. I'll tell you why. If you ever looked at the weaponry that the thugs, the gangbangers, are carrying in the streets of this country, if you ever looked at the fact that they outgun our police, you've got subhuman morons in the streets of these cities with submachine guns, 223s that could penetrate a police car, and our poor police are running around with a 40 caliber handgun with maybe 12 or 14 shots in it. You've got gangbangers boasting that the police are running away from them because they outgun them. And you're telling me the police are not entitled to their pensions? You are wrong. Why don't you strap on a police uniform one day and take a ride through one of these neighborhoods? Because you've got a war going on in the streets of America. And frankly, we need more than police. We need the U.S. military in the streets of America to seize the guns of the gangbangers. You heard me. Seize the guns of the gangbangers. Because the police are getting knocked off like flies. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Las Vegas, Kurt, what's your lifestyle question?
Thanks, Dr. Savage. I guess I'm just looking for some advice or to see what you do in my particular situation. Now, I'm 26 years old, and I've been married for pretty much 6 years now with my wife, and I've known her since we were 14, actually. We met in high school. We weren't high school sweethearts, just good friends. And as time gone by, you know, I joined the military, and I'm going to make it a career. I know that in my heart that I love it, and I'm trying to follow in my family's footsteps with it. And
beautiful.
That being said, too, I'm putting myself through college because I want to better myself inside that career and also have something I can do once
fantastic.
I get out after I serve.
Fantastic.
And as I'm getting older and, like, hitting it as hard as I can, my wife, she's just a stay-at-home wife, and she just, I mean, all I ask is please keep the house clean, you know, cook, do whatever you need. You just, you know, just support me at home because I'm going to do all the work. And just put yourself through school. I'll pay for it if we have to. I'll go any
route. But she doesn't want to go to school. She doesn't even want to do that.
No, like, honestly, we had the same exact classes this past semester, and it's a long story, but because of what she pulled, she decided to drop out, although I was ahead of her in the classes, and I was basically giving her the work, like, this is all you have to do.
Why did she drop out of school?
She just said she couldn't handle it, because, well, we have a son at home, and he's a special needs child, but she said handle anything with having.
All right, so she's a little overwhelmed from the special needs situation.
Yes.
As someone who had a brother, which I did, I don't know if you know, I had a brother who was born what they called brain damaged in those days. It seriously affects the other children. It affects the mother most profoundly, but it also affects the father profoundly. So you got to cut her some slack here. You know, she's filled with conflicts because both mother and father feel that they're somewhat at fault. And the guilt with regard to a special needs child is something that is never, ever discussed so far as I know. Yes, of course, you should focus on the child's needs, but the parents also have to be dealt with what they're feeling. I mean, you yourself probably have some problems with that, right?
Oh, I definitely do. And the thing is, this isn't our first child. Our first son, he actually passed away because of just a genetic malformation. And we found out through negligence of the doctors when they did genetic testing.
Oh, God, what a mess.
We were both
What a sad, sad story. And you still have the heart to want to go into the military despite all of these terrible things that have happened to you?
Oh, yeah, I'm in the military. I've been in for about 4 years now, and I absolutely love it. I love doing my job every day.
Well, thank God you have a structure that is bigger than you, in which you can lose yourself. That is really the most important thing I have heard. But your wife is the problem now, correct?
Yes.
So what is it you'd like me to answer? I don't quite understand which part of this question I can help with at all.
Just with everything, like, weighing down on me, and just I just feel like I have to drag her along. It's not, I don't mean to be harsh about it. I know.
No, be harsh, because she's not listening to the show, obviously. Is that correct?
No, not at all.
Is she apolitical?
Is she political? No.
No, I'm saying so she is apolitical. She could care less about politics.
Oh, yes, exactly.
Does she know that you're very political?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Does she care about your politics? Does she find you to be too right-wing, too conservative or anything?
I find it bores her, you know, for the majority of it. It's like kind of.
Yeah, so you don't have that in common. You don't share a common political orientation, which is difficult. So what do you share other than the burden of the tragedies in your between the two of you? Do you share anything else?
We used to have more common interests when we were younger and when we were friends, and and we still seem to share some when we actually first got together. But as time goes by, it's just more and more of it has just dropped off, and it's, you know.
How are you doing financially?
Financially, I take care of everything, and I run the house as far as finances.
No, I'm saying, do you have enough money as a member of the military to support your family right now?
Yes, I do. More than enough, actually. I've made some good.
You see, this is an interesting thing because, you know, military personnel are underpaid to begin with, but here you are saying I have more than enough. So you're not a greedy man. You're a very interesting person. You're a very good person. You want to give to the country, and you are giving to the country. You're a good father. You're a good husband. And you feel that your wife is somehow not a drag on you, but you don't know how to motivate her is what you're asking, what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. I just don't know what to do. I'm like kicking and screaming in the dark, and I've told her that. Like,
and I assume you're calling this radio program because you have no one else to turn to. Is that correct?
I mean, I've talked to family about it, but like somebody who's not family, not a close friend, just somebody on the outside, just, you know, unbiased opinion, who don't really know either of us and just can hear the situation.
Well, there's no way to kickstart people. You can't come up with some magic idea like bring home a Barbie doll for her and she's going to react to it. I'm using a metaphor, of course. The problem here is systemic between not between the two of you necessarily, but this woman has already, she's lost a child, right? You said you lost a child?
Yes, we have, and we're going to lose her.
Okay. Now you have a second child who is developmentally disabled or what?
It's a whole slew. You probably know the terms. Miller-Dieker, lissencephaly.
Oh, God, you're a poor God. It's terrible. Terrible suffering. You've got to understand your wife is suffering. She's in very deep pain, and I'm sure you do know that, correct?
Oh, yes. Yes, I do.
So you're afraid that if you don't do something and you don't intervene, she's going to drift further and further away from you and further away from an active life, and she's going to become a complete vegetable lost to the world, is what you fear.
Exactly.
Where is her mother in all of this?
You know, I want her to progress in her life. And
No. Where is your wife's mother in all of this?
Where is she? Actually, another addition to the story is I'm actually slotted to go overseas in 4 days and for a year away from her, so she's with her mom in Florida.
Oh, my God. Is her mom at all helpful?
Oh, yeah, she's very helpful. She's a very, very wonderful woman, definitely.
I'll tell you what I'm going to do for your family only because you've touched me so deeply. It's not a big deal, but it's a token of my gratitude, and I'm sure for the people who are listening to this program across America. If you'll be so kind as to give us an address that is not on the air, but to my my producer on the Savage Nation, I'm going to send you a gift of $500, and it may not come until next week, but I just want to give you something personal for that, okay?
Wow, thank you. I don't know what to say. Thank you so much.
Other than I'm sorry to hear you're going through such terribly difficult times, so I hope we don't get calls now of people who want money because I'm not going to give out any more money. I mean, it's just awful because as someone who's seen what a child who is handicapped does to everyone in the family without knowing, they don't do it. But what having a handicapped child or a developmentally disabled child, the effects upon the mother, the father, the other siblings is overwhelming. And people don't even understand it. And a father like this, who still has the strength to care enough to stay in the military and fight for his country, God bless him. I'll be back.
Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
This is a battlefield that we must stand upon. And we need to let President Obama, Harry Reid, Nancy Pelosi, take your message of equality of achievement, take your message of economic dependency, take your message of enslaving the entrepreneurial will and spirit of the American people somewhere else. You can take it to Europe, you can take it to the bottom of the sea, you can take it to the North Pole, but get the hell out of the United States of America.
Whoa. Ooh, someone got mad. Somebody got mad, and that someone joins us right now, one of my favorites in Congress, Congressman Alan West. An honor to have you on the Savage Nation.
Well, Dr. Savage, it's great being back on with you and sharing with the Savage Nation. Thank you.
Well, there's a lot to be said here. I'm sure that people are outraged that you dare say a thing like this. What's the heat been like?
Well, you know, I don't care about the heat because I have to tell the truth. And I think that there are times when you have to tell the American people what they need to hear and not what they may want to hear. And we don't need to sugarcoat this anymore. There was a message out there that is the antithesis to everything that we are as a constitutional republic, and it does not belong here on these shores. And I think that if this message continues to permeate throughout our nation, we're looking at the future and the legacy of this America that we should be all in love with be lost for our children and grandchildren.
Absolutely. In fact, if Obama is not stopped at the ballot box, we're going to lose the nation completely. Look at this story, Congressman West. Obama administration offers $75,000 grants to sign up more food stamp recipients. Can you believe a thing like this?
Yeah, well, you have to get inside of his head and also the head of the liberal progressives. If they can get more people dependent upon them, dependent upon government, than there are out there producing, then they're going to win. It's just a sheer numbers game. And I think that when you go back and you read a book like Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand, or you read many of your books, you see exactly the roadmap that these guys have, and that is to get more people on food stamps. You've seen a 16% increase of people on the poverty rolls. To get more people that are sitting back saying, what will the government do for me, instead of unleashing that entrepreneurial spirit and American will, which is what I talked about, and that's what we have to get back to.
Over the last 3 years, Congressman, the number of Americans on food stamps has skyrocketed by two-thirds. Mm-hmm. It stands at a record high. 46 million citizens, or one out of seven people in the U.S., is on food stamps. But apparently that's not enough for the Obamaites. They want more people, and they're offering $75,000 grants to groups who devise strategies to increase program participation. Why in the world are they allowed to get away with this? Where is Congress?
Well, you know, that's one of the things that we have to stand up and fight against. You know, when Newt Gingrich said food stamp president, he tried to get some heat. I went on news shows, and I said he's absolutely right. So I think that one of the things we have to look at is they have to come to the House of Representatives. We're the keepers of the purse, and we just won't allow them to have that. And
you mean they can't just do this by
Yes.
I'm sorry. So they can't just do this by fiat, give out that grant?
No, they can't do it. There are things that they can do by regulatory fiat, and I think you see that coming out of the NLRB. You see that coming out of the EPA. But you just can't start writing off money. As a matter of fact, the Obama administration is already about 2 to 3 weeks late on presenting their budget for fiscal year 2013, which you would think in the last year of his presidency they would be able to do. But then again, he's out campaigning all over the country. So, you know, creating a budget is not that important since we've gone close to about 1,007 days without having one.
What do you need a budget for? You have, if you have Air Force One and a host of servants in the White House, what do you need a budget for? The nation comes last. Congressman, a caller asked me about you and your district, and she said, she alleged, and I think it's true, that your fellow Republicans are going to gerrymander your district out from under you. Is there any truth to that?
Yes, right now that seems to be the case. The Republicans in Florida have a supermajority in the House and the Senate. They have taken my district and made it about 4 to 5 percentage points stronger for Democrats. And I can't explain it. I don't understand it. There were many great citizens down here that are constituents of this district that supplied them with maps that would have met all the legal standards of Amendment 6 down here and also the Voting Rights Act. But, you know, it is what it is, and I'll just have to fight hard.
Well, why are they doing it? Is it because you're too conservative? They say because you're a Tea Party favorite? The Republican Party, is that disconnected from the will of their own base that they would do this?
Well, I think that you would probably have to call the Speaker of the House designate there and the President of the Senate, call the folks in the Florida legislature and ask them, because I can't explain it. And as a matter of fact, I'm just trying to do my best to be a good congressional representative for the people here. As a matter of fact, we had a hearing down here today about this oil rig that is about to be in place about 60 miles off Florida shore, which the Obama administration has been providing technical advice and guidance. It's a Chinese-made rig. It's a Spanish company, and they're going to start drilling off the coast, something that we're not allowed to do.
What in the heck? I know that there are something like 9 foreign nations drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, yet Obama prohibits Americans from drilling in the Gulf?
Yeah, well, that's in the Gulf. We're talking actually right off of Cuba's coast. And if you understand the Gulf Stream, and this is in waters that are deeper than Deepwater Horizon, if there is a catastrophic event, you're looking at South Florida just being absolutely decimated and our economy being destroyed. And let's not forget that 2 weeks ago, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was visiting Cuba, and I'm sure they were talking about strengthening their ties.
Astounding what's going on in this under this administration.
And
I have to agree with your emotional outburst when you said they should leave the country, because they do not represent American values. There's no question. That's what you meant.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, I didn't you know, direct that toward individuals. I direct it toward their message. Their message of equality of opportunity, that's not America. America's about equality of, equality of achievement. America's about equality of opportunity. Their message is about economic dependency. America is about economic freedom. And, of course, how they are enslaving the entrepreneur will, which is causing so many small businesses to close up so that Americans have to be more dependent upon government. I want to unleash that entrepreneurial spirit and get capital flowing out here so we can get more storefronts open back up. So
Why do you think that the Democrats chose such a I'm going to try to use a polite description of Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Why have they chosen such a provocative, angry, distasteful human being to be their chairman?
Well, I think that, you know, my colleague from down here in Florida, she represents the liberal progressives that are now running the Democrat Party.
You mean they're just all mean-spirited, foul-mouthed attack dogs?
Well, I think that that's what you see. And I think, you know, the sooner that the Republican Party understands that this is a bare-knuckle fist fight, they will, you know, maybe be victorious in this upcoming election. But if they think that this is going to be a nice, simple, fair fight, I want to tell them a lesson that I learned from a Marine first sergeant by the name of Jim Reifinger. He said, if you ever find yourself in a fair fight, it's all because your tactics suck. This is not going to be a fair fight.
No, it isn't. And that's what worries me about Romney. When I heard about a few months ago, he said, oh, Obama's a good man. He's just over his head. I said, oh, my God. Here we go. It's John McCain. It's John McCain. It's John McCain all over again. That's why McCain lost in the last election.
Now, we can no longer be a punching bag for the liberals, and, you know, that's why I'm the number one target for the Democrat Party, because I see them for who they are, and I'm willing to call them out on it. I just hope and wish that my fellow Republicans from top to bottom will do the exact same and not isolate those of us who want to stand up for principle with pragmatic passion behind it.
Well, before you leave us today on the Savage Nation, what can people do who are concerned about what the Republicans are doing to you? That's what worries me. Here you are, a Republican star. You're a true conservative. You're a war hero. Why are they trying to cut the legs out from under you by redistricting your own district, meaning gerrymandering you out of business? What are they trying to achieve here?
If I could answer that, I would get $1 million. I think that, you know, maybe you can call up to the Florida legislature and see if they'd be willing to come on your show and explain it. And the good people in the Savage Nation can contact the Florida legislature and, you know, ask them a very simple question, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot.
I hear you. Congressman West, always a pleasure. By the way, I hope the next time you that I'm in Florida and you're down there, we can say hello again. In regards to your lovely family.
Oh, my family would love to see you again, sir, and thank you so much.
And by the way, I know what they like now for food.
Yeah.
No, I remember we had a whole bunch of Italian food out. Everybody liked the same exact dish. I didn't have enough of it.
No, it was great. And I look forward to breaking bread with you again.
All right. Thank you again, Congressman Alan West. Imagine if we had, let's say, net 100%. Could you imagine what this country would be like if we had 25% of Congress as authentic frontline combat troops come back and want to serve America in Congress? Can you imagine the different world we'd be in? Can you imagine if 1% of reporters were former combat veterans instead of about 0.00001%? What a different country this would be. You know, 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com.
Savage.
Freud's theories about sex are as relevant as ever, and so although some of them have undergone revision, many current psychologists think that the founder of psychoanalysis was completely wrong about everything. He had everything backwards, and they've tried to undo what he did. It's part of the deconstruction of Western civilization, by the way. By bringing down Freud's theories, so they think, they can bring down and collapse all of Western civilization and completely turn civilization on its head. There are certain things you can't change, and you cannot take a giant and turn him into a Lilliputian.
particularly if you yourself are a Lilliputian and not a giant. The fact of the matter is, sexuality has a central place in our psyche. So you say, well, okay, I don't want a college lecture today on the Savage Nation. I've heard all this, or I haven't. I'm not interested. Talk instead about Newt Gingrich or Rick Santorum. I don't want to do it. I mean, I am so bored of politics right now. You know, what'll be will be. I think that I would rather talk about something positive, which is, if you're driven by sexual thoughts or urges, how have you sublimated them into something positive? Okay, but how have you channeled your hypersexuality, so to speak, into something positive? Because I would argue that all of civilization is built upon sexual energy, if you want to take it from a strictly... I am probably strictly, from a psychological point of view, a Freudian in that regard, even though I'm not a therapist at all. I never pretended to be, nor do I want to be. But if you were to ask me what school of psychology, Savage, do you follow, it would be Freudianism. Because he was a giant. He was the founder of psychoanalysis. But even he had his limitations, and he acknowledged it. Even he once said, if I remember correctly, that not everything was about sex. And he once commented, you know, he said, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. Okay, so let's not get carried away. You know what I'm saying? He understood that there was a limitation even to his theories. Now, I know many of you don't agree with Freudianism, but that's really not what the show is about right now. It's how do you use the energy, your sexual energy. New York City, WOR, Nando, welcome to the program. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Michael, you know, I'm a psychologist in New York City, and I agree with you that Freud was a giant in a lot of ways, but he did get some things backwards. For example, he assumed that the disturbance was sex-based. But a lot of people get disturbed first and foremost about other things like ego, their status, their anger, their rage, and then they employ all kinds of methods to...
Well, let me see. I'm not here to dispute better. You because you... Hold it. I'm not going to dispute because you know more about it than I do, but I want to see if I can follow your ideas. You said that the anger and the rage control them, but what drives the anger and rage is what I'm interested in.
I think... From a modern cognitive behavioral point of view, it's the stuff they tell themselves. You know, you and I can look at the same situation, and we tell ourselves different things. If your premise is one of, let's say, an unconstrained vision, you're more liberal. If you have more of a constrained, tragic view, you're more conservative. So both of us can look at the
Wait a minute, that was pretty glib of you. Wait, yeah. I want to hear that again. Let me hear that again. That was beautiful. Let me hear it again and see if I agree with it.
Well, this is a theory that's been out there, I guess, for like sort of a dozen years or so, which is that some of us have sort of a tragic view of life, which is that there are constraints on the world, you can't have everything you want, and those people tend to become conservative.
Hold on, let me think about that. I have that viewpoint, but I don't think that's why I'm a conservative. But okay, now give me the liberal viewpoint.
That's one factor. But then another factor is if you believe I can have it all, in fact, I deserve it all, and somebody should provide it, otherwise the world is wrong and unfair towards me, then you tend to become more liberal.
You mean that the world owes you a living, in other words?
Yeah. Right. Now,
all right.
So people...
But I would just add to this, since we're getting into the strictly political, that I was speaking with a boatsmith today, a man who came out and fixed some wood on my boat today. He's an expert in mechanics. And we were working together. I mean, I was watching him. He was taking out broken screws and fixing a broken rail. And he's a businessman. And he said to me, every businessman he knows on the Sausalito waterfront is ultimately a conservative politically because they don't like hyper-regulation, and they hate high taxation, and they all love my show, is what he was saying. So in other words, even though they live in this liberal area of San Francisco and they work on the Sausalito waterfront in the boat industry, anyone in business recognizes that big government is against them. I don't think that has anything to do with emotions or sexuality.
But that's right, and people can get disturbed and then use sexuality. But even there, you know, if you have a moral view which is everyone should be equal, then you're going to view injustice as anything that makes more money for one.
Well, I don't believe that. I don't believe everyone can be equal.
Right.
All we have to do is look at a basketball game and understand that there are some people who are better at basketball than others.
Right. Well,
okay, and then I apply that to every sphere of the world. You're not going to take everyone and turn them into a nuclear physicist, for example, or a surgeon. That's absurd. That's absolutely the communist point of view. And you know that that went on in communist China after the revolution, which is what scares the heck out of me and makes me sick when I listen to these unrequited leftists who tell me that every moron in America can become a brain surgeon if only they were given the chance. That's utter nonsense.
I agree with you. In fact, that's called the moralistic fallacy, that because I might be disadvantaged in some way, it's wrong, and therefore it isn't so. That's really a fallacy that says that if it's wrong, it isn't so. And that doesn't follow.
Well, look, you're a psychologist, and I have sympathy for educated people in this field, but I want to ask you, you said Freud had it backwards. Tell me how he had it backwards.
Well, he had it half right in that sex, really, not sex evolved to get our genes into the next generation. So in that sense, he was correct. But he said that he made these fixed rules about these stages that you have to go through, and that if you didn't properly go through these stages, then you'd be messed up in life and have a...
Oh, what, the oral, the anal, the phallic, et cetera? Yeah, that whole theory?
I think he made all that up. And but the reality is that when people get disturbed of various sorts because they put themselves down, or they put others down, or they put the world down, they get enraged, or they get grandiose, then they're so upset that they use different means to appease themselves, whether it's more regulation or hurting others or...
But what about in Freud's view that sexuality as the causation of all neurosis?
I think you got to be very careful. I mean, obviously, sex is important in the sense that it motivates a lot of what we do. Now, a lot of that is unconscious. He was correct about that. Because, let's say, if I study painting or something, I'm not consciously thinking that this is going to get me laid. On the other hand, it might help me get that.
Well, what do you think people go to museums for?
Yeah, right. So...
I'm joking, but how many people that are in museums are there to meet somebody? You have to ask yourself, you think everyone's there just to look at the paintings and the sculptings? I would think a lot of people are going there to meet sophisticated people looking at paintings and sculptings. Yeah. In addition to looking at the art, they're pretending they're only looking at the painting, but maybe through the corner of their eye and the corner of their mind, they're hoping to meet somebody like themselves, somebody else who appreciates fine art.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
The useless Department of Homeland Security is keeping tabs on who is saying what on the conservative side of the aisle. Now you say, well, they're monitoring all journalists. Nonsense. They really have to monitor ABC, CBS, or NBC, or CNN, which does their bidding. They're monitoring the minuscule small number of people who speak out against this government when this government steps out of line. And remember, it's the job of the people to keep the government in order. A government that is not kept in check will become an out-of-control rogue government. I have an excerpt in my hand from a book that I recommend called They Thought They Were Free by Milton Mayer. And it was written about the Germans between 1933 and 1945. The book is called They Thought They Were Free. You have to understand that what went on in Germany, what went on in every other dictatorship on earth, and what's going on right in front of your nose is going on here in America. It's not as if this administration wishes to become a dictatorship. It is this dictatorship that it is, and it's bringing you along step by step in ways that you can't even understand. I'll read it to you. What no one seemed to notice was the ever-widening gap after 1933 in Germany between the government and the people. Did you hear that? The widening gap between the government and the people. Does that ring true? What happened here was the gradual habituation of the people, little by little, to being governed by surprise, to receiving decisions deliberated in secret. Does that sound like Obama? Every night another secret? Every night another secret decision? To receiving decisions deliberated in secret. To believing that the situation was so complicated that the government had to act on information which the people could not understand. Or so dangerous that even if the people could not understand it, it could not be released because of national security. I'm talking about Germany in the 1930s. Does it sound familiar to you? I will go on if you wish, because it's happening to you right in front of your eyes. I'm not suggesting that Obama plans on creating death camps. I am telling you, though, that he's absolutely on the road to a pure dictatorship. He is fascinated by the power he is able to grab because no one has stopped him. When he's gone from A to B in a tiny step, he wasn't stopped. When he crawled from B to C, he wasn't stopped. When he walked from C to D, he was not stopped. So he's now bounding from D to E and E to F and F to G. I'm telling you what's going on, and I'll quote again from Milton Myers, they thought they were free, the Germans 1933 to 1945. Would you like to hear one more sentence, or is this too much for you because I'm not saying, Romney, Paul, it's Gingrich. No, I really think it's that Gingrich. Hey, that Santorum's moving up. Well, who's moving down, Wolf? Let's go into an old coffee barrel and ask some crackers what they have to say about, ooh, Romney, Gingrich. Now, you have to ask yourself why Romney, Gingrich, Paul, why none of them are talking about Obama granting amnesty to 315,000 El Salvadorans. Now, it's not called amnesty. They were scheduled for deportation, but he just said he's not going to deport them because of an earthquake that occurred several years ago in their home country. Do you think that this is not an example of what his plan is for getting reelected, which is using the illegal vote? To me, it's as clear as a bell. I told you this a year ago. But you see, it's done step by step, day by day, and most people couldn't understand that a dictatorship did not grow overnight. Do you think when Hitler was elected, by at that time it was 32-33% of the vote, that's the number of Germans who voted for 33%, do you think overnight he created death camps? Do you think overnight he became a screaming mad dictator? He did not. It was done in ways you can't imagine. I'll quote again. To live in this process is absolutely not be able to notice it. Please try to believe me, he wrote, unless one has a much greater degree of political awareness than most of us had ever had occasion to develop. Each step was so small, so inconsequential, so well explained, or on occasion regretted, that unless one were detached from the whole process from the beginning, unless one understood what the whole thing was in principle, with all these little measures that no patriotic German could resent must someday lead to, no one more saw it developing from day to day than a farmer in his field sees the corn growing. One day, though, it is over your head. Your little men become your bosses and your dictators. All of these petty bureaucrats who you like to mock right now in the government are step by step becoming your little petty dictators, and you have no control over them. You have absolutely no recourse over them. You have no way to redress your grievances about what Obama is doing. Homeland Security is monitoring conservative journalists. They have a statement from the Department of Homeland Security. And here it says. It says the information can permit the identity of an individual to be directly or indirectly inferred, including any information which is linked or linkable to that individual. DHS, which does not know what its mission is, DHS is out of control. It's an out-of-control agency created by George Bush, by the way. It was created by George Bush, perhaps with decent intentions, although I don't really know what big government thinks. And right now, the DHS announces that the NCO and its Office of Operations Coordination and Planning can collect personal information from news anchors, journalists, reporters, or anyone who may use, quote, traditional and or social media in real time to keep their audience situationally aware and informed. What the hell does that mean? Why is DHS monitoring journalists? Why are they monitoring people in this country? That is not their job. Where is this intelligence collected by Janet Napolitano? Where is it going? Who is reviewing this data? Why are they doing this? Well, I said all I can say to you. The rest, of course, is not up to me. All I can say to you is this. Do you think that the day, did you ever believe, you liberals, is this what you envisioned when voting for Hope and Change? That you'd wake up to a fascist dictatorship under the guise of anti-terrorism? Is this what you liberals wanted, Hope and Change? Because you, too, will be caught up in this web. Make no mistake about it. Make no mistake about it. If you think that it's only going to affect people who are conservatives or patriots or nationalists or right-wingers, you're crazy. You're out of your minds. Peter Niemöller was a cardinal in Germany who spoke for the thousands and thousands of Germans when he spoke after the war and said that when the Nazis attacked the communists, he was a little uneasy. But after all, he was not a communist, and so he did nothing. And then they attacked the socialists, and he was a little uneasier, but still he was not a socialist, and he did nothing. And then the Nazis attacked the school teachers, the press, the Jews, and so on, and Niemöller said he was a little uneasy at each step, but still he did nothing. And then when the Nazis attacked the church, because he was a cardinal and a churchman, he did something, but by then it was too late. You see, my colleague went on, one doesn't see exactly where or how to move. Believe me, this is true. Each act, each occasion is worse than the last, but only a little worse. You wait for the next and the next. You wait for the one great shocking occasion coming from Obama, thinking that others, when such a shock comes, will join with you in resisting him. You don't want to act or even talk alone. You don't want to go out of your way to make trouble. This is a wide open opportunity for the Republican field to run right across the field with a touchdown against the Obama administration. They could do that today. They could do it tonight. They could do it right now. And yet they're not doing it. And why are they not doing it? Both political parties are owned by big money, big money. And big money needs illegal alien labor. Illegal alien labor is fundamentally dictating this election. And anyone who goes against illegal alien labor is not going to win. That is why even Ron Paul, by the way, who is perhaps the most conservative in some ways and the most socialist liberal in others, that is why Ron Paul, the clever doctor that he is, has said almost nothing about illegal aliens. Have you noticed that? Have you heard one word coming out of anybody's mouth about the illegal aliens? No. And yet this, to me, as a talk show host, with my stethoscope being more accurate than any pollster in America, the number one issue emotionally in this country are the great millions of illegal aliens in this country. That is the greatest emotional issue that is not being exploited by the Republican field. Houston, Texas, Darren, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Dr. Savage, love you, love your show. I want to tell you that you are the only person speaking out about drawing these parallels to Nazi Germany in the 1930s. And most Americans, Doctor, unfortunately, won't understand your references because they've never been taught history. You are 100% correct. Hitler, everybody thinks, well, Hitler was this horrible dictator, which he was. But he didn't seize power. It didn't happen overnight. It took him years to be, and he was given the chancellorship. And then he slowly took over the Reichstag. And then he passed all the laws that stripped the citizens of Germany.
Yes, it was done. It was done step by step, small step by small step. And some people saw it but didn't say anything. But listen to this from that book by Milton Meyer. They thought they were free. It's an amazing thing because everyone listening to this show is going to identify this. He says, your friends put you down as pessimistic or even neurotic when you say something against your government. They try to intimidate you. So you're left with your close friends who are naturally people who have always thought as you have. And now in small gatherings of your closest friends, you feel that you are talking to yourselves, that you are isolated from the reality of things. This weakens your confidence still further and serves as a further deterrent to what? It is clearer all the time that if you are going to do anything, you must make an occasion to do it. And then you are obviously a troublemaker, so you wait and you wait. And you're waiting for that one great shocking occasion from the government to occur when tens or hundreds of thousands will join with you, but it never will come. That's the difficulty. If the last and worst act of the whole regime had come immediately after the first and smallest, millions would have been sufficiently shocked in Germany. if, let us say, the gassing of the Jews in 43 had come immediately after the German firm stickers on the windows of non-Jewish shops in 33. But, of course, this isn't the way it happens. In between come all the hundreds of little steps, some of them imperceptible, each of them preparing you not to be shocked by the next. Step C is not so much worse than step B. And if you did not make a stand at step B, why should you stop? Why should you at step C? And so on to step D. And one day too late, your principles, if you were ever sensible of them at all rush in upon you. The burden of self-deception has grown too heavy, and some minor incident, hardly a minor incident, collapses it all at once, and you see that everything has changed and changed completely under your nose. The world you live in, your nation, your people, is not the world you were born in at all. I can go on. I don't have to go on. It was written by Milton Mayer. The book is called They Thought They Were Free. It's about the German people between 33 and 45. And I am telling you that I see the same parallels in this country. When a president can grant billions and billions of dollars to cronies, and not one word of it is said, not one word of it is discussed by any of the candidates on the other side. So you have to ask yourself, who is behind all of these debates? Do they really expect the Republican to win, or is it just sort of a fake charade about democracy, when in fact the fix is in and the Democrats get another 4 years?
Savage.
Joyce in New York.
Hello, Mr. Savage. I'm delighted to be on your show. And a couple of months ago, I heard you describe a dream where you were singing in the streets. And I was almost going to call then because I realized that I could interpret that dream. And that dream is that you are a messenger and that you have something to say. The dream that you just had is the Eastern symbolism is the current condition of the world. The lady that you saw leave before you is America.
Mm.
And the reason you don't want to go is because you're the last voice standing.
Oh, my God. What an interpretation that is. In other words, America's life has been sucked out of her by the imagery was very, very clear. It was an Egyptian tomb. And it was of a seated woman, as you would see in, you know what I'm saying, Egyptian pictograms from Egypt, ancient Egypt. They always showed seated individuals, or very often they showed them seated, right, in an L-shape type of thing, like body, legs. And then she was brought next to that image, superimposed on the image. She fit perfectly, and they sucked her into it. I think that is the Arab Spring destroying America. In other words, this Arab Spring that we are being sold as the one of the greatest lies in history. It was orchestrated by Jimmy Carter, Brzezinski, and those in a think tank funded by George Soros. It was documented in a 16-page essay that I wrote about a year ago. They were behind the overthrow of Mubarak and what is going on in the Middle East. Now, what is it that they're doing? Are they trying to destroy America knowingly or by accident? Just remember, it was Jimmy Carter who overthrew the Shah of Iran and in so doing brought back Ayatollah Khomeini, who was in exile in France, and that started the disease, the virus, the AIDS virus of societies across the world. Radical Islam was stirred up by Ayatollah Khomeini, and it was a result of Jimmy Carter's do-gooderness. Either Jimmy Carter didn't know this would happen, he did it because he thought the Iranian people were suffering from Savak. He didn't know that the Muslim terrorists who would take over the country were worse than Savak, the secret police. In other words, the Islamic fanatic secret police are worse than Savak. So now we see the same thing going on in Libya, going on in Egypt, and this country is being sucked into this by the media. So are you saying that's Lady Liberty being sucked into that vortex and I resisted going?
Yes, I am, and especially when you said that she went and she conformed, and that's America.
Well, she conformed to the image that the silhouette was just exactly in her dimensions, is the point.
Yes.
She tried it on for size. They brought her next to the size, and she fit, and then she disappeared. Invisible hands pulled her into that
Next World. And then I remember being led there by invisible hands, or forces, rather. And I knew they wanted me to go. I wouldn't go. And I screamed, no, I'm not going. I would scream with everything in me. I'm staying here for my children. I'm staying here for my children. So you're saying I'm staying here to fight for America for my children?
You're staying here for us. You're the last voice standing.
Joyce, what do you currently do professionally?
I'm a food service director.
Food, the way to a man's heart is through his stomach. To me, food is not disconnected from the mind. It's very much one and the same.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. We all love our warriors. We all love our heroes. We all know that they're the only thing that stands between us and 1,000 years of darkness. And last year, August 6, 2011, more SEALs died in one incident than in the entire history of the SEAL unit. 29 rough, fearless warriors were put aboard a CH-47 Chinook helicopter in the black of night and sent off onto a mission from which they never returned. Joining us right now to talk about one of these SEALs are the parents of Special Ops Chief SEAL Aaron Carson Vaughn. Billy Vaughn, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. It's a privilege to be here.
First of all, Mr. Vaughn, all we can say is God bless you, and we send our condolences. I'm glad to see America can still produce heroes. But from my point of view, as simply as a talk show host, something is wrong with this picture. Why were so many SEALs put into a single old helicopter?
I can tell you why they were put in the old helicopter. I can tell you why they were put in the CH-47. What we have been told is we don't have enough MH-47Gs for special ops to perform their missions right now. So I think, and this is my opinion, based on information. So it's based on something at least. The special ops missions have been, and they've told us that they're ramped up. They've ramped them up so much because the conventional operation is winding down, and to make it look like to the American public that the war is winding down. That they just simply don't have enough special ops choppers, and they're flying with what they have. And that night they were using a CH-47, and so.
Well, let me ask you this: the MH-47 is a newer, faster machine.
I tell you what, sir. It is. I can't tell you what the difference is between the MH-47G and the CH-47. I don't know anything about choppers, but what
I don't want to put you on the spot. The question to me as a civilian whose heart was broken, even though it wasn't my son, thank God, and it was your son who you lost, one of America's best and brightest, and many others, they were all put into one helicopter. Why not three Chinook helicopters, for example?
What I can say about that is they wanted they wanted maximum power on the ground immediately, and I'm not going to say any more about that.
You don't want to impugn the military. I understand that. I mean, I get that.
Well, I mean, the military has explained. I'll just tell you the truth. As far as what Karen and I know, the military has answered our questions satisfactorily, as far as we know. But the people in Washington have not. On the fact, the rules of engagement, they weren't even able to fire the AH-64 Apache in the sky, when he saw the RPGs fired, was not able to return fire because of the rules of engagement set by this president. And at least that's what we're told. And then they are not.
So you mean as the RPG was on the way toward the helicopter, the supporting helicopter, the Apache couldn't fire at the terrorist?
What we were told, this is what we were told on more than one occasion, because I asked and some other people asked the question several times, as the CH-47, as the Extortion 17 came into land, two Apaches were overhead watching everything that was going on, and we actually saw the videotape of the last minute and a half or so. We did not see the RPGs fire, but we could hear the audio from the Apache, and the Apache's one of the pilots said, "Oh, so and so, there's an explosion. Oh, so and so, there's another one. Extortion 17 is down." That pilot saw the RPGs fired, we are told, and he was not able to fire on the men who fired the RPGs, because the rules of engagement stated that there could be friendlies in the same building as to where the fire came from. So he did not return fire.
Meanwhile, your son, Special Ops Chief Aaron Carson Vaughn, one of only 300 of America's most elite warriors and 29 other rough, fearless American warriors, are gone. There's never been no congressional investigation. So far as I know, it was covered up or dismissed immediately. Instead, we hear about a junkie singer who died after trying to commit suicide. I mean, it's sickening. To me, it's sickening that the junkies and the degenerates are given funerals and support and parades. And guys like this, well, I should stop because it gets me crazy. And the fact of the matter is, you and your wife are making yourselves available to speak publicly across America, you say, in an effort to carry the torch that your son Aaron passed to them. What is it that you tell students, Mr. Vaughn, when you go out to speak?
Well, I tell you, Mr. Savage, actually, Karen speaks to the students, and if you would ask her that what her message is, she can say it better than I can.
Please. Karen Vaughn, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Michael. Thank you very much for having us on tonight. My message to students is really simple. I want them to become more informed about what's happening in their government. I don't want them to be pawns in the hand of what's being fed to them by the liberal media. And I try to tell them to seek information, be informed, and to do your part in this world, to not sit back idly and let things happen around you with no action or recourse of your own, and especially don't be shameful enough to be completely unaware of what's happening.
Mrs. Vaughn, you say that although we cannot be engaged kinetically in the preservation of our republic as your son Aaron was, we now feel an obligation to become engaged culturally. That is a brilliant statement, and it's something that strikes a chord with me, because millions upon millions of Americans cannot become engaged kinetically to preserve our republic from all of the threats, internal and external, by the way. But they can become engaged culturally. Isn't that true?
That's exactly right. And I'll tell you something, Michael, that I really learned quickly as Billy and I launched this campaign to inform our circle of influence, is that people will listen to people they trust. There are people like you out there with mass audiences, but every single person isn't listening to you, right? And I wish they were, but they're not. But our circle of friends will listen to us, and they trust what we share. So I believe that everybody who is informed has not only a need to, but an obligation to get out there and spread the word if these things happen, especially Billy and I are taking up the cause of radical Islam in our country and the way it's taken over our country.
Right. And yesterday,
concerning to us. Yes.
Well, that's right. Your son devoted his life to that. And the other day on the Continental Airlines plane, there were a couple of Islamic guys screaming Allah Akbar. They had to be subdued not by the Homeland Security, not by TSA, but by ordinary men from Texas,
right,
who jumped up and subdued them.
Right, right. Because our country has become impotent in this entire battle. They have become completely impotent with political correctness, and it's nauseating as a mother of a son who gave his life to fight it.
Is there anything, Mr. and Mrs. Vaughn, didn't your son leave behind a wife and children?
He did.
A wife and two
little
children, yes.
Is there a foundation, is there any place that my listeners who have the biggest hearts in the country can make a donation? Do you have a website? Is there anything online where they can go and do something?
There is a Facebook page that's set up for Aaron, and there's information on there on how to donate to his children to a fund that his wife has set up in their honor. And if you look for In Memory of Navy SEAL Aaron Vaughn on Facebook, you can find that page, and the information will be there for making donations. Thank you very much for asking that. Thank you.
In Memory of Navy SEAL Aaron Vaughn, V-A-U-G-H-N, In Memory of Navy SEAL Aaron Vaughn. I recommend to all of my listeners who want to engage culturally to defend this country, because the government is too busy having a blues festival in the White House to pay any attention to this. A government that took a White House and turned it into a frat house, in my opinion. Don't get me started on that. But, okay, here we are. We the people have to do it. And you gave the ultimate. You gave the ultimate to this country. You gave the ultimate. And for people to sit back and say they can't do anything is utter nonsense. They can. And I'm going to recommend everybody listening to this show seek out that website, that Facebook page. And can I make a recommendation, Mrs. Vaughn? When you get around to it, set up a website that's very easy for people to remember. And if you want, I'll help you do it. And I'll put it up on my website absolutely free of charge so that the children who don't have a father have a little something to help them get through life.
Right. Thank you. We will do that. Thank you very much. I really appreciate that.
Well, I don't want to pull you into this any deeper. I can imagine the depth to which you have already gone.
Mr. Savage.
Yes.
I'd like to say a couple other things. I don't want to say anything. I don't have anything to say at all about the military, but I'm engaged now culturally, and I'm working with the United West, and they are an organization that is fighting radical Islam, and Aaron was fighting radical Islam abroad. We need to fight it here at home, because it is infiltrating us like a bad cold. I mean, it's just coming.
They're advising the FBI. They're telling the FBI director what they can say about radical Islam.
That is correct. And we have an administration that I cannot figure out the reason why they are so sympathetic to them, but it is among us, and it is going to overtake us if we don't wake up. And that's why we said on our website that we are engaged culturally. We have to win the war here in America. They know they cannot defeat us abroad. Their plan is to win the war right here, to soften the battlefield until they can do it right here. And I'd like to say two things in defense of the military while I'm on the phone. I'd appreciate it. One is, I'm sick and tired of people like Hillary Clinton and Leon Panetta and Jay Carney and people like that talking about our Marines because they urinate on Taliban. I'm not saying I would do that. I'm not saying it's right. But I'd like to see somebody in Washington, D.C. stand up for our military. And John McCain doing the same.
Mr. Vaughn, I wrote an article about this for USA Today. I was surprised that they let me do it. But I took the position of exactly your position about the alleged incident that after a firefight, we don't know what happened. How many Marines were shot, killed, blown up? After the firefight, the men who risked their lives peed on some corpses, and I'm supposed to get upset at them? Are you kidding me?
Exactly right. Let me tell you something, Mr. Savage. On the night that our son's chopper was shot down with the 29 other Americans, all that the AH-64 could do was fire suppressive fire to keep the enemy away from the bodies of the warriors. And you know why they do that? Because they will mutilate the bodies. They will mutilate the bodies. Nothing is said about that. All we have is somebody like Hillary Clinton saying, these are not our American values. I doubt Hillary Clinton has any American values that are the same as mine.
Amen. I don't think she knows what an American value is. She's hardly in this country. She's too busy placating the greater world. Because after all, she's a citizen of the world, Mr. Vaughn. You can't expect her to pay much attention to the little old country called the U.S. of A.
That's exactly right. And now today, one more time, Mr. Savage, we have an American general in Afghanistan apologizing again for our troops.
Oh, my God. We played that yesterday. It set off a shockwave, Mr. Vaughn. Did you hear that soundbite?
I hear again, though. As far as I can understand, we did what was right. They were not supposed to write in the Qurans, and then they are according to...
Absolutely. These Qurans were part and parcel of materials that were in the holding cells, or the cells, rather, of the equivalent of prisoners of war, who were then released from their cells, and their books were burned because they had messages in them. How hard is that for the general to understand?
No, I just don't get it, sir. I do not.
Well, look, I think we both see the picture. Unfortunately, it may be as ugly as we fear. It may not just be political correctness. Some of us think that the government, or at least some in the government, are playing for the other team. And we should leave it at that, because there's only so far we can go on an open microphone to millions of Americans. Again, I want to repeat, for those of you who are listening, we are speaking with the parents of one of the brave, heroic Americans who was unnecessarily killed on August 6, 2011, when he and 29 other fearless American warriors were put into a CH-47 Chinook in the black of night and never came back. And his name, that you never forget it, is Aaron Carson Vaughn. And he has a Facebook page that his wife set up. Maybe the people can find it. And what is the Facebook page again, please?
In memory of Navy SEAL Aaron Vaughn.
Now, do you folks have your own website?
We do. We do. That site is For Our Son. That's FOROURSON.US. FOURSON.US.
And that will give people some information about your sacrifice.
Yes, sir, yeah. It will, and about what Karen and I are trying to do, and we started putting an occasional blog on there and providing people with information, and we're beginning to try to do our part and pick up where our son left off.
Well, I want to say thanks to Aaron Klein, who was a writer for WorldNet Daily, who gave me your contact and said you'd be willing to speak, and Mr. and Mrs. Vaughn, believe me, America respects you from the bottom of their hearts. Pay no attention to those in Washington. As you well know, there's this disconnect between those at the top and those of us who have to run our lives. God bless you, and thank you very much for what you've done for this country. This is the Savage Nation, FourOurSon.us, FourOurSon.us. God bless Billy and Karen Vaughn, and in the memory of Aaron Carson Vaughn, I take a quick break.
Savage.
You got to laugh at some mild infirmities. You know, a guy gets in a fight when he's a kid, he gets a tooth knocked out. What are you going to do about it? Nothing. It's a tooth. That's all. That's all. It's only a tooth. It's nothing. It could have been worse. Because I remember when I was a kid, like 18, 15, you know, I never thought I'd live past 40. I really didn't. Come from a family of horrendous male longevity. I don't blame them. It was just the way it is. So my friends and I used to joke. We used to joke when we were kids. We'd look at older men, guys over 30. Some of whom were bald. And I remember saying to my friend, and I said, you know what, I'm not worried about baldness because I probably never lived that long. And we used to joke about it. I swear, young guys are funny. We always had a fatalistic view of things. But as time, and there was another story I'll tell you from that era. I remember I told you I had a friend whose father was the tough guy in the whole like thing in the ghetto. All the other guys had little stores or little jobs. This guy owned a bar on the Upper East Side of Manhattan before it was cool. He was a professional bar owner wearing a suit, not a bartender. a gambler. He was a real, you know, let's say, cool type of guy, but he was a man's man. So guys liked him. He had a manly way about him. He talked quietly, never spoke loud, hardly spoke at all. And sometimes when the families would get together in those days, all the families got very often got together on weekends in someone's apartment or house, he would sit down and the guys would listen to him. And remember he said to us, he would say things, he would say, you know, he says, you know, when you hit this certain age, like at 50 and your teeth start to fall out, he says, I don't want to live past 50. I hear the guy's 95 now living in Florida.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
If you have a question that's plaguing you, I'll be your lifestyle coach for 5 minutes. Since I have reached a certain age and have a certain degree of knowledge and wisdom that you could use. I mean, look, when you give money to an expert to advise you on something, you go to the expert because you figure they know more than you do about the subject. That could be a tax accountant. It could be a psychiatrist. It could be a lifestyle coach. It could have been a teacher. Some authority figure who you feel knows something about certain things. And if you're lucky enough to get on the show through my call screener by calling 1-800-449-8255 with any lifestyle question, you'll be saving thousands of dollars because you'll get a free answer for whatever it's worth. Truthfully, I mean, that's what I'd rather do. So I'll start with anything but the election right now. I can't take it. I can't take any more of it. I'd rather talk about igneous rocks than Barack Hussein Obama. I would rather talk about the crustacean, the Democrats versus Republicans. I would rather talk about evolution rather than Democrats versus Republicans. I would rather talk about Serpentine Rock rather than Newt Gingrich. I'd rather talk about the molecular structure of magnesium rather than Ron Paul. Anything, please spare me. Don't do this to me anymore. I can't take another second of it. Play the Life Coach theme so they know what we're talking about in the Savage Nation. Yeah, oh, that's nice. Desafinado. Desafinado. That's Stan Getz, right? Yes, Stan Getz, Desafinado. 1958 Chrysler was what I had at the time. My father's used car with it. She had a big block Hemi engine in it, I remember. I remember I got T-boned in a crosswalk after an afternoon with a Playboy bunny. No, in those days you could drive after a nice afternoon of pleasure. Today you go away for 7 years. I wasn't speeding. He hit me, and the guy went through a red light. He T-boned the car, and like a Hell's Angel hitter came over. He bought the car for the engine. I remember. I think he paid me $300 just for the engine. They hauled the Hulk away. It was a big car, beautiful engine. Incredible. See, every song has a certain memory attached to it. What are they calling? Okay, Las Vegas, Mike, welcome to the Savage Nation. Mike, go ahead. You're on the Savage Nation.
Hi, Doc. I want to know if you're ready for art lesson number two here for you.
Go ahead. I'm listening.
All right. Before we talked about doing some tracing with graph paper.
Yeah.
Now you got to keep the picture, the photograph that you took, you got to keep it on.
You know what? No, Mike, truthfully, nobody wants to. That's not art tracing a picture, is it?
I'll tell you why. You're taking the photograph, and Norman Rockwell, he did the same thing, but he did with projection, with a projection screen.
What do you mean? He projected an image on a screen and painted over it?
No. He just drew the outline. You're not painting it. You're just going to draw the outline. Very light lines. You're not doing the whole picture.
I'm not painting anymore. I put my paints away since I came back from Florida. It's very interesting. The light here doesn't do the same thing to me that the light in Florida did. The light in Florida was so intense that I started to paint. Now that I've come back to California, although it's beautiful, the intensity is not the same. So my paints are in the top of a closet. I'm not interested in painting again. Isn't that weird how light is so different in different parts of the world? But I like his idea of tracing. That's cheating, as far as I could tell. But, you know, look, John Nagy launched the art careers of many, many people, which reminds me of the campaign we're watching. It's like a campaign created by John Nagy, where it's the numbers. You just follow the numbers and something comes out of it, you know. What is this? Is that a call? No one's calling? Does anyone have a question? Not a question in the whole bunch. No, please, I cannot have any. If I see the word Romney, Santorum, Paul, Gingrich, or whatever else the names, I'm not taking the call. Blank them out. I'd rather go to a blank screen like an artist and trace on my own, on my call board. I can't take it. I swear to you, I'm regurgitating mentally from this. 15, 16 debates, I've had enough. Yeah, here's a lifestyle question. Mike in New York on WOR. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Dr. Savage. I wanted to ask, my 19-year-old son is a liberal arts major, and he's a really good kid. He's straight. He's into playing guitar and video games. And other than that, he knows not what he wants to do. And I'd really like to help him refine his search in terms of a career goal.
How old is he?
19, just turned.
No. Most kids at 19 don't know what they want to do. So don't feel alarmed by that. Did you know what you wanted to do at 19? I didn't.
No, I certainly didn't.
No, I didn't. I was always groping and searching. Nobody really knows what they want to do. Very few do. Let's put it that way. Those who are driven like that usually want to become some bottom-feeding lawyer who deceives and lies to people. They have an idea from the time they're 9 years old that they're more devious and a better liar than their fellow kids in school, and they become lawyers. But other than that, how many people at 19 know what they really want to become?
Well, liberal arts, I feel like he's wasting his time doing a...
Well, they don't have an alternative called conservative arts yet, do they?
No, that would definitely make...
No, liberal arts consist of how to put a condom on a cucumber, how to roll a doobie, and how to hate America. Those would be the three liberal arts that they learn in college. How to hate your parents, how to hate the church, and how to hate anybody who has anything more than you. That's the liberal arts curriculum today, especially at NYU. But, I mean, your question is a serious one, which is how do you motivate your son to try to pick his way through this morass called life, right?
Absolutely.
All right, so I'll give you an answer. We'll start with the basics. How does any boy or girl figure out what they want to do to make a living? How do they figure that out? What do they do to figure that out? Well, first they have to find out what jobs, if they're just looking for a job, assuming he's not wanting to be a professional, so to speak, of any kind. He doesn't want to go to a law school, medical school, dental school. He doesn't want to be an architect or an engineer. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. So you've eliminated most of the white-collar professions. Therefore, what does he want to do? He has to make a living primarily, correct?
Yes.
All right. So how hard is it for him to go take a job in retail in New York? There are probably thousands of jobs going begging. And you say, well, who wants to work in a lowly paid retail job? The answer is nobody, really. But he gets exposure to humanity that way. And in this exposure, he might get inspired through somebody he meets or something he sees. The trick is to get him out of the house. He's got to work somewhere. Mike,
yes.
Your name is Mike. Mike, he's got to take a job is what he's got. Is he working now?
He's giving guitar lessons to young kids, and he also is helping my sister in the communications business, but he does a lot of running wires, Category 5 wires and things of that nature.
What do you mean? You mean electronic wires and Cat 5 wiring?
Yes. But,
so he's into electronics?
Yeah, I'm only insofar as my brother-in-law has been training him. My brother-in-law has a business doing that, and I tried
So he is working. So he is. He's not a total slacker. He's not sitting home like Wayne's World in the basement, is he?
No, but he's a part time, and he doesn't like it. You know, he doesn't.
Well, of course, he doesn't like it. But that's how life works. Is you take a menial job and you don't like it, and you say, I don't want to do this anymore. I can't stand it. You figure out a way that you're going to make more money by doing something else. You train for it, or you get next to somebody who has a better job, and you take the job. I mean, there's no magic answer here. How did you get? What do you do for a living?
I'm in financial services, actually, and I did exactly what you said. I hit my head along a few pipes and tried jobs, and I didn't like them, and eventually became into financial services where I helped families.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So there was no magic. Your father didn't come along and give you a silver wand like Mitt Romney's father, and give you you didn't have a fortune. You had to fend for yourself.
Yeah, I just feel like I failed, or I am failing, I should say, that I am not.
But that's the thing, is you feel as a father that he should have been doing better than you already. And you feel that in America, the land of opportunity, the son is supposed to succeed the father financially and socially. That's basically what you feel. And you don't understand why your son has fallen behind you, I think, is another subtext to this conversation.
Yes. Yes.
All right, indeed. But Mike, he's young yet. He's not 39, is he?
No.
If he was 39 and still living at home with you and your wife and had a hairnet on and was smoking a joint, I would say you have trouble. But he's a kid. He's only 19 years old. You know, give him time. He'll figure things out. He'll either go with his likes and make a living, or he'll go with his likes and find out that he can't make a dollar doing it. And then he'll say, I can't do this anymore. And he'll become something where there's a job. He'll go back to school for 2 years and become whatever is necessary. He could go, you have no idea what he's liable to do. Just be there for him and love him and tell him it'll work out if he keeps working. That's all you can do for him, Mike. You can't force it, and you can't get angry. And most of all, don't feel badly because he's a young kid yet. He's very young.
His professor, he just signed up for the winter module in his community college, and the professor wanted him. He said, Dad, I don't like this professor. Yeah, I think you'll get a kick out of this. She made it mandatory that they subscribe to the New York Times. When he said he wanted to drop out of our class, I said, any professor, I want you to subscribe to that rag. I want you to drop out of our class. By all means, you want to withdraw, withdraw. And I gave him my full approval on withdrawing out of our class. But I thought it was interesting that a sociologist...
Well, I don't know that you can force him to subscribe to the New York Times, but the fact of the matter is, I wouldn't say... I was afraid you were going to say that she forced him to subscribe to The Nation or some other overtly communist, rag. All right, stay with your kid. Just remember, Mike, you're feeling bad for yourself that you don't see a more motivated son, but you're not alone in that. How many of your son's, your friend's children are motivated today?
I have a few. I guess that's why I'm a little dejected.
What do you mean? Guys who are like the young guys are already driven into jobs, careers, professions?
Oh, I have one friend's son who's 21 years old, and the kid, he already works for the New York City Comptroller's Office. He's interviewing at some of the biggest firms, and the kid is just, and it's all not because of daddy's affiliations. The kid is just an absolute go-getter, knows that he wants a financial...
All right, so, but not everyone's the same way. Your son is on the more autistic side, right?
Yes, indeed.
All right, so he's withdrawn. He's probably, introspective. He doesn't like to run around and compete with people that much. He's a different type of personality.
Absolutely, and that's what worries me.
Yes, but Mike, not everybody can be a driven personality who always wants to get ahead and is willing to do anything to get there. It doesn't mean you don't love them, right?
No, of course.
All right. Well, Mike, we'll probably never talk to each other again. This is actually a very heartwarming and also it's a troubling conversation in a way, Mike, because you're not the only father in America who is worried about a child. You're one of tens of millions of parents who wonder why their child is not motivated or has fallen behind them in terms of the great American success chase. I don't have a single answer for you other than to say continue to love your child and encourage them to work, because in the midst of even the most menial job, they are likely to meet people who will guide them in ways you could never imagine. I'll be right back.
Savage.
You have to have a very peculiar personality to want to get up in front of an audience and perform. What do I need that for? I don't understand. What do people need an audience for? It's one thing to do radio where you don't have to look at anybody and tell them what you think. And if you make enough sense over a long period of time, you'll have a big audience, as I do. But to stand up in front of a crowd and have them clap, why? What kind of personality defect must you have to do that on a regular basis, to be a performing artist? No, think about that. You need the applause of mommy and daddy in the audience? You're that insecure you need them to love you? It's an interesting psychology, the whole performance thing. I don't know. Don't people outgrow it? Don't entertainers act like they have enough acclaim and enough, you know, don't they say enough is enough, I don't need it anymore, I'm healed? I don't know about that one. It's an interesting one. Okay, let's take some callers. Jonathan from Washington State, wherever that may be, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hello, Mr. Savage.
Yes, what's on your mind?
Hey, I had some life advice I was seeking. I'm currently an English major. I'm in my senior year, and I'm really torn between two careers, politics and possibly teaching. I want to get out and teach abroad as well. But I was wondering what your advice would be as far as
If you want a career in the media, you're in the wrong major. You should have had a major in Ebonics rather than English. Mm-hmm. And then you might be hired by MSNBC because the better your English, the command of English, the lower your chances are to work in the American media or in politics. In other words, the lower your vocabulary IQ, the lower your VQ, the higher is your employability by any media outlet in America. If you can say contraception, abortion, then you're hired by ABC. So you don't know which one to follow? Is that it?
I'm just very torn.
Let's start with this. What about making a living? Is that covered already? Did you inherit enough money to just kind of do what you want or what?
No, I'm looking to make a career. I'm interested in at least I want to help in the vote. 2012 elections, I have a few legislators that I'm going to be helping out in the
okay.
my local
so
area.
What is the actual question? I don't quite understand. Are you saying should you teach or should you go into politics? Is that what you're asking?
Right. I want to go into possibly working as a legislative aide, et cetera.
But do you have an opportunity to be employed as a legislative aide?
I'm looking at if I volunteer on some campaigns.
That's how you start. You have to be basically an intern for nothing. And then if they like you well enough, they'll offer you a job. If you've got enough on the ball and they can see you're really motivated, they'll hire you. That's basically how the game works, Jonathan. It's never changed. I mean, everyone's looking for a young person who's very bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, so to speak, who's willing to work hard.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Born through a party in the county jail. The prison band was there and they began to wail. The band was jumping and the joint began to swing. You should have heard this knocked out jailbird sing that rock.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. In a few seconds, moments, we will have Jack Abramoff on. I read his book, Capital Punishment, which was astonishing. You know, I figured, all right, the guy got in trouble. He wrote a book. What do I care about a lobbyist, you know? But then I looked at the pictures and I looked at the book. I could not believe it. Here is a man who has had an amazing life to this point, born in Beverly Hills, an aggressive high school football player, was a top college Republican leader, was well-known in the conservative movement alongside Ralph Reed and Grover Norquist, and winds up as one of the most successful lobbyists in American history. And then there comes the fall. It's a truly American story, Capital Punishment, The Hard Truth About Washington Corruption from America's Most Notorious Lobbyist. Joining us right now is Jack Abramoff. Jack, thank you very much for being with us on the Savage Nation.
Thank you, Dr. Savage. Thanks for having me.
Jack, I mean, come on, you've been through some ordeal. What you did certainly is not different than what many people have done and are doing now. Let's start from the top. Would you agree with that statement?
No, I think you're right. It doesn't make me less guilty, of course, but definitely that is true.
Now, when you say guilty, guilty of what?
Well, two things. One, I was guilty of crossing the line of the law. But maybe worse, I was guilty of participating in a system where too much that's corrupt and bad is legal. And so in both cases, I was guilty.
It's interesting because in reading your book, I realized that you went through a sort of revelation in jail. And you admitted to yourself that you did cross the line and you had lost any perspective of where you were at, is what you wrote. Isn't that true, more or less, in my words, rather?
Yes, it actually is true. And frankly, part of it, part of the ability for me to really rethink what I was listening to you every night in jail, as a lot of the guys did.
Oh, come on, really?
And rightfully so.
You actually listened to the Savage Nation in prison?
Absolutely. Yes, I wasn't alone.
Well, which prison were you in, Jack?
I was in a place called Cumberland Federal Correctional Institution in Maryland.
Now, this is an interesting part of the book, and this is one of the reasons that it appealed to me, is that people say, oh, he was in a white-collar prison. It was just like a university. It was a slap on the wrist. I was shocked to see how you were mistreated. And one scene in particular jumped right out of the pages. You ordered a Christian Bible, even though you yourself were an Orthodox Jew. You ordered a Christian Bible for an African inmate. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, and the Bible came, you put it on a shelf in the library for him. You were then called down to the authorities, who said that they were throwing you in the hole. And you said, what? And then you went to a hearing and they said, because you distributed contraband in prison. You could not believe it, and you said, the last time I heard a thing like this was in the Soviet Union. Is that a fair summary of what you wrote in that book?
That's exactly right. Yes, exactly what happened, tragically.
So how could they call a Bible contraband material?
Well, I mean, technically, anything that a prisoner gives to another prisoner becomes a contraband. But I didn't give it to him. I put it on the shelf, and that was the way that I saw it.
So that's the equivalent of giving him cigarettes, a Hershey bar, or methamphetamine as a Bible now, because there's no mental, there's no mind running the prison system. Or were you singled out and they were waiting for you to trip up so they could punish you even more, Jack?
I think it was a combination of both. I think that they were certainly at the beginning waiting for me to trip up, and they were trying to do everything they could to get me perhaps to trip up, and I just didn't trip up. I tried to behave as best I could. But then there's also, in the prison system, there's certain rules, and they're going to apply them. The problem is I saw myself many times, inmates handing each other contraband that's real contraband, cigarettes and worse. But none of them were ever put into the situation I was with a Bible.
Unbelievable. How many years did you serve in prison?
I was there for 43 months, a little over 3.5 years.
Good God. So that's pretty bad. And I watched the movie Casino Jack, which was somewhat based upon your fall from grace. Who was the actor who played you in the movie? I forgot.
Kevin Spacey.
Yeah, he's a terrific actor. I really like him as an actor. I don't like his politics, but I like his acting. And I try to bifurcate the individual's profession from his politics. But, you know, I don't think that he did a portrayal of what actually happened to you in prison, Jack.
No, didn't. I mean, the movie was written by a screenwriter in Canada who, you know, kind of took from the Washington Post. Spacey came and met me in prison with the director. Spacey tried to make it a little bit better, but as you know, when you're making a movie, once the script is set, you can't do much once you got the script.
You know, in your book, you have pictures with various politicians, including Tom DeLay, Newt Gingrich, and others. Have you heard any complaints from any of these people for you associating yourself with them after the fact?
Well, I know Newt and his people aren't very happy with what I'm saying about him. I'm not positive about him. I think that he's not worthy of running for president. But I recently wrote a column on for the WND site about it as well. But DeLay, I was in touch with since prison, is, you know, very friendly and my support for what he's enduring. That's pretty much it.
Now, you know what's interesting? There's many interesting facts in your book, Capital Punishment. And I'd like you to go into some of them, Jack. Maybe we'll take some callers after the break where they want to ask you questions. What's amazing to me is that you lobbied for many companies, and then you had very big clients in the Indian gambling industry, and that was apparently what brought you down. It was one tribe against another, wasn't it?
Yes, very much. People mistakenly think that Indians, just because they're all Indians, are all on the same team. The tribes don't view it that way any more than Germans and French view themselves as Europeans and they should never go to war.
Or that Christians think that they're all in bed together, or that Jews all think that they're on the same wavelength. I mean, we've got problems within the Orthodox Jewish community between the Satmar Hasidim and the Lubavitch, for example, that borders on warfare. So I wouldn't think it's any different than any other ethnic group or any other religious group.
Exactly.
So, you know, I mean, so you are a religious man. Did you go in as a religious man?
Yes, I've been religious since I've been 12.
So, you know, this is a difficult question for me, Jack, but if you were religious and if you truly believed in your religious beliefs and in the Torah, how could you have strayed so far from the center line?
Well, I'm a sinner. I mean, is the bottom line. I made mistakes. But worse than perhaps doing things that, you know, in our religion, there are people who make mistakes. They know they do it, and they correct it, and they get punished, et cetera. The worst problem is when your philosophy is wrong. In other words, if you're in a boat and you have a sextant that's 1 degree off, all of a sudden you having things looks good to you. And then by the time you hit the rock somewhere, you realize that you've been totally messed up, and that was the case with me.
So, Jack, do you care to make any comments about your experiences with Newt Gingrich? Because you said before that you don't think he's qualified to be president. I don't think you're alone in that opinion. I mean, I share it for sure. But why do you say that? You know him. I never met him.
Well, for a number of reasons. Number one, he's not somebody who seems to even be able to hold a focus. He flip-flops more than the leper father in Braveheart as to what side he's on. And I just find that he's, throughout my dealings with him, that one just never knew where you were. I talk in the book, in my book, Capital Punishment, I talk about a time I went in to talk about the western Pacific U.S. territory called the Marianas and the problems
mm-hmm.
he's having there. And he listened for a few minutes and then declared that, why don't we just combine them with Hawaii?
Now, oh, my God, that's absurd. As someone who lived in Hawaii, it shows he has no idea what vast distances and differences there are between the cultures of those two island groups.
Right, exactly. And to him, they were islands, and that was the solution and end of discussion. And it was emblematic, really, of how dealing with him. But from a conservative point of view, this is not a conservative. He's certainly no more conservative than Romney is. He's flip-flop all over the place. The column I recently wrote, I went through about 15 things that he's been on the bad side of, including funding abortion, including everything else. And I just think that this is not the guy who conservatives should be voting for. We should look seriously to win this election, and doing it with him, I think, would be a big mistake.
Jack Abramoff has written a book that I recommend called Capital Punishment, not just because it's an interesting story, but it's a moral tale, and it's an important moral tale. He's a man who went over the line, knew he went over the line, went to prison and had a revelation or several in prison, and is trying to tell others to, you know, kind of stay this side of the law. Jack, in I know we're going to talk about this a little more, because many people think that it's a cakewalk in these white-collar prisons. And as I've already indicated, you were singled out. You were thrown in the hole for distributing a Bible to a fellow inmate. Even though you're Jewish, you bought him a Christian Bible. What is life like in a white-collar prison?
Well, first of all, there are no white-collar prisons. 10% of the inmates in the prison I was in every federal prison are white-collar guys. 90% are drug dealers. They are
wow.
people who have come down from the maximum and medium securities and through the 20-year sentence at the end of their sentences. If they haven't been violent, they'll put them in a camp because it's cheaper. But there are no white-collar prisons any longer in America, at least certainly not the one I was in.
So, okay, this is interesting. It's sort of a mixed population of ex-drug dealers and formerly violent inmates with white-collar guys. So what is how do you survive in such an environment? I mean, you're a big, tough guy, former sports guy, but that means nothing in a prison environment.
Right, exactly. I mean, you know, where I was, first of all, with me, since I was in the news virtually every day, they were still putting me on television. I was kind of a weirdo to the inmates. I got along with everybody. I didn't mix myself into anybody's business and just tried to stay out of it. If you do that, you don't wind up getting hurt and you don't wind up getting in any trouble. But we lived six men to 150 square feet. That was the room we had. And
wow.
You're on top of each other all the time. And, you know, it's just very hard. It's very aggravating.
Well, especially coming from the heights that you were living in, Jack, I can imagine what that must have been like. But you've survived it and you're out. You're now writing books. You're working with World Net Daily. Are you back in business outside of those areas?
Well, I'm trying to get back into – I used to be a motion picture producer, so I'm working on a few projects in that area. And, you know, my business opportunities for an ex-felon are limited, and I'm certainly not going to go into lobbying. I've actually been offered a lot of money to go back into lobbying, but I'm not going to do it.
Isn't that something? Of course. That's like a guy who declares bankruptcy. I remember when my father was a small businessman, used to say to me, couldn't understand it. He never did it, but others in the business that he bought from would build up big debts. They would declare bankruptcy, and I'd say, well, how can they ever go back in business? He would laugh. He would say a day after they declared bankruptcy, people wanted to do business with them again. I said, what? He said, they needed them, I guess. I said, same thing with you.
It's bizarre. And, you know, I had a skill set in that area, unfortunately, but it's not something I'm going to do. If anything, I'm frankly out there trying to clean up the system at this point. And it's not. Let's just say this. I'm not getting man of the year from the American League of Lobbyists this year.
I'll be right back. It's the Savage Nation.
Savage.
I went up to a mountain this morning. I normally bicycle in the morning, not early, late in the morning, after I've done all my emails and had the breakfast and calculated how much cholesterol versus how much fish oil versus how much vitamin E versus how many milligrams of this and milligrams of that, before I titrated my body ready for another day on the slopes of America. Then I go out in a bike ride, but I didn't want to ride today. I'm bored out of my mind. So I hiked up a mountain in the San Francisco Bay Area because it's eerily like a very, very spring day here. There's no rain. There's a terrible drought. People are enjoying the weather naturally, and myself included. And so I go up to an eerily quiet mountain in the Bay Area and hike by myself. And I look at the rocks, and I try to say to myself, Michael, you're a trained scientist. You're in the media, which is a pretty low-life job to begin with. You try to elevate the dialogue to a certain extent in what you do. You don't succeed, obviously, because the people only want to hear the mud. They don't want to hear about anything above the layer at the bottom of the ocean. They want to lay with the crustaceans, because apparently the politicians today are like crustaceans. Zero leadership. And I look at this, and I realize that the rocks I'm looking at on top of this mountain, these bluish rocks, were a result of a cataclysm that began about 165 million years ago. And they were thrown up into the air, onto the surface of the earth at that time, onto the top of this mountain. You say, well, wait, now you're getting off the track. Now you're talking about serpentine rocks on the top of a mountain. What does that have to do with Newt Gingrich and the election and Obama the communist? Well, I don't know what it has to do with it. I mean, you know, you ask yourself, if you're in this business, try to put some perspective on this. You have one gang of interests versus another gang of interests. They're called Democrat gang, Republican gang. You have two competing philosophies as to how the economy should be run. One gang says, take from everybody who earns and gives it to the non-earners. Tax those who work and don't tax those who earn very little. The other people say, wait a minute, that's not fair. But fundamentally, there's no difference in them socially. So now we have Newt Gingrich, who claims to be a conservative, claiming that a fiscal conservative candidate is bad. So what does he want? The answer is, if you're stupid enough to not understand this, I can't help you. That's why today I had to pull myself out of all of this and go up to the serpentine-rich areas of this mountain and look at some of the mountaintop. And as I'm looking at the rocks, I got to tell you, it's related to the economy in a way. I know I'm a little, you know, discursive here, but I look at the big rocks on the top of this mountain, and they're made up of magnesium, nickel, cobalt, chromium, etc. And I think back to the Civil War that almost bankrupted America, and I realize that here in California, in the neighboring state of Nevada, we had, which was once the largest silver stores, I think, discovered at the time, the Comstock Lode. And do you know that the Comstock Lode of silver was used to pay off the Civil War debt? Now, think of what I just said to you. The war cost a great deal of money. The war nearly bankrupted America. But in those days, the politicians couldn't just print money. The money was tied to silver and gold. And so they used the silver, the minerals, in other words, in the earth of Nevada, the natural resources of Nevada, to pay off the war debt. Now, speed the clock forward. We have the Iraq War, which cost this country about $3 trillion, according to some estimates. Those ungrateful SOBs in Iraq have not sent us so much as a barrel of oil because we haven't taken it, nor have we demanded it. You know what I feel about that. We should have taken the oil to pay off the war debt at the very least. But the war debt was never paid off, and that was the beginning of our bankruptcy. Now, you can blame the welfare state all you want, and believe me, there's plenty of blame for the welfare state in terms of our bankrupt state. But the fact of the matter is, it was the war in Iraq that probably began the road that we will never come back from. We have not yet paid off the Iraq war debt. We're not paying off the Afghanistan war debt. Where in the world do you expect this to come from? I ask myself every day, when in fact they're not paying off the debt. What should we talk about? Serpentine rocks? Would you like me to talk about hiking on the mountain today? Serpentine rocks? And the fact that within 110 years, everyone listening to the show will be dead? Do you realize we all share something in common? We're all traversing through the universe at the same time. And that within 110 or so years, everyone listening to this program, in fact, everyone on the planet, whether they were just born or they're 95 years old, will be off this planet. You'll be gone. And you'll just be part of the compost, if at all. And that when you look at a mountain like this and you realize that it was created about 165 million years ago, you know, you realize that life unto itself is a miracle. Our place on this earth is miraculous. It's only for a short dance in the sun that we're here to begin with. How much can I talk about what these empty suits from television have to say about reality? How much can we take of this? What country are we living in that we permit this to go on? How did the system devolve to this point?
Savage.